This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to be talking later in our show about Mark Andrews, political person of note in North Dakota and who served 24 years in Washington, D.C. as a representative and senator. We'll be talking about him with our news director, Dave Thompson. But we're going to start our show with Mark Schneider. He's a well-known attorney and a person who's been involved in human rights across the state of North Dakota. But now he's a novelist, and he joins us to talk about his new book, She Has the Right of It, An Irish-American Story. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug. Good to be here.
First of all, I'll just ask you about Mark Andrews. Any reflections about your interactions with this man?
I grew up with Mark Andrews and his children. I got to know his family quite well. And I always respected Mark Andrews, both as a representative and as a senator. Even though we're on different sides of the aisle, he was always a statesman. And he's the kind of politician that, sadly, we just don't see very much of anymore. And he'll be sorely missed. And my condolences go out to his family.
And back when politicians used to reach across the aisle. Let's get into the book, Mark. This is your first novel. Why did you write it?
I think I've been writing it for 50 years. I say that because I went to Ireland for the first time 50 years ago. I chased a certain woman named Mary, who has a certain resemblance to the Molly in my book, the Molly Doherty in my
yes.
book. Molly was in Experiment in International Living between her sophomore and junior years at NDSU. And she made the cut and got the slot to fill as the visiting scholar. And so she was in Dublin for the entire summer. I just graduated from college at NDSU in 1970, and I used my degree to bust tires at my old man's tire shop for $2.20 an hour to make enough money to chase that redhead over to Ireland. And I've been chasing that redhead in Ireland ever since.
Well, it's thinly veiled fiction to me as I read through the book, because there are lots of places and personalities that jump out at me as people I've seen or places I've been, like Bub's Pub, for example. That's not even subtle, Mark.
No, it's not. It's not very subtle. Same thing with St. Mike's School, too. People who went there will know it. But I wanted to bring alive what it was like, really, to be raised Irish Catholic, certainly, in Fargo, North Dakota, in the late 50s and early 60s. It seems like such an idyllic time. Of course, we know better. I mean, I was back still during the Red Scare and Sputnik and the bomb and all of that. But it just seemed like such a simpler life. And it was for the protagonist in my novel until their lives are changed dramatically at the end of the sixth grade year to a series of tragedies. And which follows them through the rest of the book. I wanted to really bring that when I wrote my book. I really wanted to bring Fargo into it, because it was certainly a big part of my life and Molly's life. It's something that I don't think a lot's been written about. So I wanted to make sure I included that.
Well, the book weaves a couple of themes throughout it. One is the Catholicness of your Irish upbringing. Also, the politics that so mired Ireland and Britain for so many years, probably centuries, actually. But in our lifetime, things have settled down a bit. Let's talk about your upbringing. Did your father have an Irish brogue, for example?
My father, he could confect an Irish brogue with the rest of them. He didn't wear it on his sleeve, but he was three quarters Irish. I say that, you know, with a name like Schneider, it's hardly hardly an Irish heritage ring to it. But my dad was three quarters Irish, and that's where I get most of the Irish in my family. Or like the rest of my siblings say, I got all the Irish in the family. But my dad was very, very proud of being Irish. And spoke of his heritage often. And so I came by that early and often.
You clearly celebrate that heritage in the book, and the book is She Has the Right of It, An Irish-American Story. We're talking with the author, Mark Schneider. But there is some, it seems to be some internal conflict about your religious upbringing and how that overshadowed what happened in the story you tell.
Yeah, it's there's a story being told here about a certain priest who enters the lives of our two young protagonists and everybody else in their school dramatically and for the worse. And then to mix it all up for poor Molly, for poor Mark in the book, he loses Molly at the same time as her parents moved to Boston. So he's left in Fargo, and then his parents move him to public school. So his world is really uplifted between his sixth and seventh grade years, and I wanted to show that trauma. And then the rest of the book is about, you know, Mark and Molly getting back together, how that works, and then bringing in the Irish connection. Because a big theme in my book is the role of Irish women in recent Irish history, and by that I mean all of the 20th century, when Ireland finally, after 800 years, finally got independence from England. And the story, largely untold, about how women played an integral role in that freedom. But they were airbrushed out of history, very much intentionally so, by the people that took over the Republic after it got its freedom and after its terrible, terrible Civil War. And my book explores that theme, because if there's one thing that runs true about Ireland, is that there's just, it's tragedy after tragedy, which goes a long ways towards explaining the whole Irish mystique and the Irish personality. You know, as my father used to say, you know, it was only the hope of dying that kept him alive. And there's a lot to be said about that. If what the Irish have suffered through, I mean, just terrible maladies over the centuries. And then, as I point out in my book, finally to get their independence and then lose a huge portion of that freedom by inept leadership that took over. And that gets into the whole Michael Collins, Eamon De Valera, which I'm getting into the weeds and how people aren't familiar with Irish history. But those are real people. And they figure prominently in my book.
Well, the book takes place largely in two places, Fargo and in Ireland, Dublin principally. And
That's right.
You weave these various time periods back and forth telling this story. It runs from 1912 to 1970 and famously includes a big chunk of the Easter Rebellion in Dublin in 1916. And this is where these women that you referred to come into prominence. And this was a time that's been it's been in the movies. It's been in lots of books. John Connolly and Michael Collins were people of note at that time. I think both died. Connolly was executed and Michael Collins was assassinated. They were pushing for Irish independence at the same time World War I was going on. So they sort of had Great Britain on its heels in a way, and that probably made the resulting crackdown even more brutal, because it was quite brutal. But these letters that are in the middle of the book that are quite substantial to tell the story that you're getting at here about the Irish independence and the women who fought so hard for it, are these based on true letters or are these total fabrications?
No, that's poetic license. What I did there is I had my protagonist, Molly Doherty, comes across these letters in the attic when she's helping her mother with a spring cleaning, and they're this treasure trove of letters written in Irish. Something we would call it Gaelic, but it's really Irish. So they're absolutely indecipherable to the average English reader. The book starts talking about getting those letters deciphered, and then they tell the story from the perspective of these two sisters, Irish twins they were called because they were born within a year of each other, who came to Ireland in 1912 during the horrible labor unrest and saw the rebellion and the War of Independence, and then ended up on opposite sides of the Civil War. So we get that whole perspective through those letters.
Now, did you take an Anglo-Irish history course at NDSU back in your college years?
I don't think NDSU came close to an Anglo-Irish history course. I think probably Western civilization was the closest they got. I know they had the history of England, which would, if it's taught from an English standpoint, it would give short shrift to Ireland. So I don't recall any of that, and it certainly wasn't the chair of the history department being Irish.
Professor O'Donnell.
Professor yes. O'Donnell, yeah.
Okay.
He's out of whole cloth, but he's a guy I wish I had at NDSU when I was there.
Obviously, you're very interested in your heritage, your Irish heritage, and you've spent a lot of time. You've been to Ireland many times. What keeps bringing you back there? What is it about Ireland that is so attractive to Mark Schneider?
Well, it's a difficult one to answer because you don't want to, you know, everything you say almost sounds trite. There's one of the few places in the world, I think, where you can get away with saying that going there is like going home. It's a real phenomenon. Both Mary and I have it. Not everybody that goes back to Ireland or has Irish heritage in them have that sense. But even people who don't have an Irish heritage have that sense of going home. There's something about the old world embracing of what was lost and will never be again. The beautiful tragedy of it. It's like the poet said, you know, a terrible beauty of Ireland. And it's romantic, it's adventuresome, and my God, you just follow the literary giants of Irish in Irish literary history. It's just amazing. You can't help but fall in love with the country just from their works. But to actually go there time and again. And it's certainly true in my experience that every time I go, it's like going home even more so. It's just a place that I dearly, dearly love. I certainly am not alone in that. And being able to, you know, put that in a nutshell and explain, in an elevator speech, why that is true, why that phenomenon works, I think is very, very difficult. But all I can do is say my life, having been there over 50 years, I'm testament to the fact that it is a very, very special place with very, very special people.
Well, when you've lived as long as you and I have, and you can look back on decades, you can see some, shall we say, some similarities in terms of what was happening in our country when you were coming of age.
Right.
We had the Vietnam War. We had assassinations, Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy, civil rights demonstrations and anti-war demonstrations going on. It was a very, very turbulent time. And you contrast that by, you know, kind of going back to 1916 and after that in the Irish independence movement was confronting the reality of British guns.
Right. And the utter violence of it all. I mean, said rightfully so, I think, that slavery is the original sin of America, then the original sin of England is its treatment of the Irish. And credit to the English, I don't think they treated any other people or place on the face of the earth, and God knows they've had most of it, as badly as they have the Irish over literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's almost inexplicable that they go out of their way to sow hatred of the Irish. And the nearest I can come up with it is that, you know, they hate the Irish for refusing to be English. And that's one thing that you learn about traveling to Ireland. And the more you go back there, and the benefit of being old like us, is looking back and seeing that if there's anything true, is that England never was part of Britain. They may have been dominated politically and militarily, but they never, ever were part of Great Britain. They weren't like Scotland. They're not like Wales. They're not like any of the Commonwealth countries. They were always independent, and they kept their independence of spirit. if not politics, throughout.
But still reverberates today in the 21st century. You do have a country called Ireland. You have another subcountry, if you will, called Northern Ireland.
Right.
And you've got Brexit, which is still breaking across Europe and England. And Northern Ireland, that border between Northern Ireland and Ireland, is one of the most contentious points of the issue separating Great Britain or the United Kingdom from Europe right now.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's very astute to summary of what's going on right now. What's really remarkable is that you can make a good case is that the Brexit, England's Brexit from the economic European Economic Union, is what might finally bring Ireland back to being a united country, because Northern Ireland cannot possibly live, at, neither can the Republic, the South, with a hard border. And going back to the Bloody Sunday days and the thousands of people being bombed in their cars and their pubs and in their schools, Ireland's just not going to go back there, and they're not going to let Britain get away with it. And Britain, and unfortunately, I think as long as we have like a Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer's, they're not going to get away with the United States either. They're not going to be able to treat the Republic of Ireland and the Northern Ireland so cavalierly. And so the really only answer is that maybe it's time, as the Easter Sunday Accords provided back in 1998, to have a vote on it, to have a nationwide plebiscite both in Northern Ireland and the Republic to see if it's time to have a united Ireland after all.
They've been talking about that in Scotland again, too, because they've had a vote on it, but that was pre-Brexit, and now I think it's
exactly
flaming up again. Mark Schneider is the author of the new novel, She Has the Right of It, an Irish-American story. It's set in Fargo and Ireland with a brief stop in Boston for his female character, Molly, who might know Mary, I don't know. But there will be a book release event this Saturday from 11 to 2 at Zanbro's in Fargo, and you can meet Mark there, and I assume it'll be socially distanced or safe or whatever?
Yeah, absolutely, Doug. Yeah, it's... I really appreciate Greg and Josie at Zambros. This is kind of a leap of faith to do this, but very much so it's going to be the COVID aware and the social distancing and the masks will be worn. And I'll be in the back room and there'll be like two or three people at a time coming in. So hopefully I can say a few words. It'll be through a mask, but I'll get the book signed and it'll be interesting to see how it works out. But that's it from 11 a.m. this Saturday until 2 p.m. At Zambros in downtown Fargo.
Mark Schneider, retired attorney, human rights activist, and novelist now. Thanks for joining us today on Main Street.
Oh, my pleasure, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street, news director Dave Thompson and I will remember Mark Andrews.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well. And by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation.
Joining us now, our news director, Dave Thompson, to talk about the passing of Mark Andrews at the age of 94. Dave, Mark Andrews cut a pretty wide swath in North Dakota politics from the 60s into the 80s.
He certainly did. And remember, he won a special election to take the seat in the Congress in the early 1960s, served 8 terms in the House, and then was elected to the U.S. Senate, where he served 1 term.
I certainly remember being a fly on the wall in Quentin Burdick's office in the late 70s during the American Ag Movement when Senator Burdick, Senator Milton Young, and Congressman Mark Andrews were getting together to talk about strategizing garrison diversion, which was then a very big issue.
Oh, yes.
And the thing that struck me was how collegial they were. I mean, these were three North Dakota guys who knew each other real well, and they were laughing and joking, and they really were enjoying each other.
It was a different era in those days. You know, they were collegial, and they worked with the governor at the time on that whole thing. And remember, the governor was a Democrat until 1981 and then switched over to Alan Olson, who's a Republican. And during that time, they all remained very collegial, very friendly, and they were working together. As I think one of them said, we're working together for the people of North Dakota. Partisan politics comes second.
Well, Mark Andrews was an imposing fellow. He was very tall. And I can recall moderating the debate between Mark Andrews and Kent Conrad in 1986 when the big issue that was confronting us seconds before we went on the air was whether they would stand or sit. And the Conrad group was adamant that they would sit. We ultimately did. Mark Andrews was gracious enough because he was so tall, it would have been quite obvious he was about a foot taller than me or Kent. So that was my, I guess, memory of his graciousness, if you will, considering how tough that race was.
Absolutely. And, you know, he did conduct it very above board. It was a tough fought race. It did get a little bit personal at times, but, you know, when it came down to it, you know, they did stick to the issues most of the time. But I have a story like yours, Doug. When I first met Mark Andrews, I was a reporter for a little 1,000-watt station in Bismarck, Mandan. And I went to a, you know, one of those meetings of a, like, Rotary Club. And I met the man there, and he was very gracious to me. Oh, you're a new reporter. You're from UND. Good for you. And we sat and talked for about 5 minutes, you know, just talked. And it wasn't that I was interviewing him. We just sat and talked. I did get a chance to him talk after his speech, and he was very gracious to give me some time to do that. But, you know, it talked about a little bit of a foregone era. You know, it's a little bit wistfully we're looking back on it, and you could see people like
yes.
that who were gracious.
What I didn't know until I read the story about his passing in the forum today was that his dad had been the sheriff of Cass County, and his father passed away quite young after a serious accident. And I know that Mark Andrews went to NDSU and got his ag economics degree, and his wife, Mary, was the poli sci graduate.
Wow.
His beloved wife, Mary.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, again, a real typical North Dakota story. Grew up on the family farm near Mapleton. Dad was a sheriff of Cass County. That I didn't know until you mentioned that, because I hadn't had a chance to read the Forum's article. But Mary definitely was beloved, and that's a whole thing that is kind of a quintessential North Dakota story in some respects.
Many years ago now, she suffered a serious medical setback, and the two of them were sort of retired with each other for many years as well. And, of course, he lived to the ripe age of 94. She passed away in July. And we just remember, as you mentioned, as you said, wistfully, a time passed when politics was less polarized, and we had people like Mark Andrews serving us.
That's right.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
And coming up on our show after the news, we'll talk with Glenn Washington, the host of Snap Judgment.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota Public Service Commission will hold a public input session during an informal hearing about a significant increase in MDU electric customers' bills. As Prairie Public's Dave Thompson reports, that's a break with common practice.
MDU is proposing an increase in its transmission facility cost recovery rider. That would mean an average MDU customer would see another $3.35 per month on their bills. That's about $40 per year. MDU has said it's due to costs tied to electrical transmission projects, plus a drop in revenue it receives from regional electric grid operators. AARP North Dakota sent a letter to the PSC asking for a formal hearing on the increase. In the letter, AARP said the increase was unfair, especially in these uncertain times. Commission Chairman Brian Crotchis said he understands the concern.
The public looks and they think, wow, this is a noticeable increase in terms of the transmission rider. And it is.
Crotchis proposed the commission take public comment at the end of the informal hearing. He said it gives the company a chance to make its case.
I don't know if that changes the fact that people just aren't going to like it. You know, we haven't made a decision, but what's presented, I'm assuming the public's not going to find it palatable and acceptable in some instances.
The other two commissioners said they didn't have any objections doing a public input session after the informal hearing. This is Commissioner Randy Crispin.
This is bigger than I think most of our riders have been.
That informal hearing will be held October 16th. For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
And the State Health Department has confirmed 24 COVID-related deaths in the last 24 hours. The new statewide death toll, 304. This is the single deadliest reporting day since the pandemic began. The Health Department can lag anywhere from 1 to 3 days in gathering data about deaths related to COVID-19. 6 deaths reported today were from 4 to 7 days ago. 6 occurred October 4th, 4 occurred October 5th, and 8 occurred October 6th. The patients were from Barnes, Botineau, Burley, Emmons, Grand Forks, McHenry, Morton, Rolette, Sheridan, Ward, and Williams counties. 7 of them were in their 90s, 5 were in their 80s, 7 in their 70s, and 3 in their 60s. They also included a man in his 50s and a woman in her 40s. Each patient had underlying health conditions. Additionally, 495 new individuals from 44 counties have also tested positive for the novel coronavirus. Today's positive rate is 7.91%. 116 people are currently hospitalized, and there are currently 3,706 active confirmed cases. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Glenn Washington. He is the creator and host of a show on public radio called Snap Judgment. You can hear it Saturdays at 5 Central here on the Prairie Public Radio Network. Glenn, thanks for joining us today.
Thrilled to be here, Doug.
How would you describe Snap Judgment to someone who hadn't heard it?
Well, we call it storytelling with a beat. And really what that means is that this is a show that features real people telling their real stories. It's first person storytelling, and we throw the kitchen sink at it from an audio perspective. What we hope you hear is movies of the mind. It's a cinema of sound. These are stories that people have done the most amazing things. They've walked on through so many different types of journeys, and this really makes a movie of someone's real life experience.
Well, I listen to Snap Judgment. It's available online. You can find it at snapjudgment.org and lots of other places, too. It's carried by more than 400 national public radio stations. And it is, as an old professor of mine used to say, describing radio, theater of the mind. How do you find the stories?
Well, this is funny, actually. When we first started Snap Judgment about 10 years ago, The OG of public media, and at least in my space, Ira Glass, I was wondering that very same question. How are we going to find stories to make this work, especially to launch the show? And Ira Glass said, well, I hope that you have a lot of interesting friends. And it turns out that both me and my producer, co-partner Mark Ristich, we do have a lot of interesting friends. And that was kind of the basis of the show. When we were first starting, when we a super skeleton staff, no one ever gets to lift their head up. You kind of have to deal with your world. You have to say, how can I leverage the people that I do know right now to tell some amazing stories? And thank God people came through. And now, though, we find our stories all over the place, all over the world. The truth of the matter is, like I said before, people are living extraordinary lives. They're faced with extraordinary decisions. And we are lucky to get to bring them to audiences in this format.
Well, the stories are one thing, and they're marvelous stories, but the storytellers are pretty important, too. So
How do you find those people?
The storytellers, you know, it's funny, when we first started, there was, especially at the time, I believe that slam poetry was really, really big at the time. And it's very, very rare that someone can make the leap from poetry to narrative. But the people who do, they're just amazing storytellers. They have such stage presence because they've been on so many stages. And we have a show that's, because of the pandemic, it's in a bit of a hiatus right now, an aspect of Snap called Snap Live, where we tour and we bring some of the best storytellers in the world, backed by the world's most amazing band, and we rock a stage. It's very much like, let me say, any concert you've ever been to, the power, the energy, the people, it's amazing. The people who show up for that, who rock those stages, they are people who are comfortable in front of a microphone. They are comfortable in front of a camera. But most of the stories, most of the people who tell stories on Snap Judgment are people who would never get in front of anyone's microphone. And we do oftentimes have to coax these stories out of people. You know, so often a 5-hour, a 10-hour interview might be edited down to make a 10-minute story. These are highly produced stories. And what I love about it is when, at the end of it, when the piece is finished, the storyteller says, "Boy, I can't believe I told it like that."
You mentioned Ira Glass in This American Life, and that's been a staple of public radio for a very long time now. I know he brought his show. He actually brings a show sometimes to cities. He brought one to Fargo and got to put his handprints in the Walk of Fame. But curated storytelling, like what you're doing, or The Moth, or a local version of that we have here where I live called The Tell, these are real stories. That kind of gives them a resonance that, you know, just inventing something might not have.
So true. I think that people oftentimes see themselves in these stories in a different way than if I'm just going to be making something up. And it really is amazing. You know, if I tell a story about my mother, then you think about yours. If I tell a story about my first day of school, you think about your first day of school. That this type of storytelling is the closest thing that we have to empathy. The closest thing that, well, to, not to empathy, to telepathy. It's the closest thing we have to getting inside someone else's head. And I think that it creates empathy in a way that other things just really can't.
You know, I listened to the story, The Time Traveler, which aired October 1st. Or yes. Was streamed October 1st, depending on how you listen to it. And that storyteller was very evocative. It's only 18 minutes, and the time traveler tells a story so well and so deeply that it's a wet eye program by the end. And it tells a human story that's very important about racial relations, among other things, and human relations, the storyteller's relationship with his grandmother, and the fact that the time machine is this house he walks into and this person he talks to. It's just a wonderful way to share humanity.
I'm glad you dig it. That was a story, the storyteller there, Jacoby Cochran, that's a case where, yeah, this guy, he knew how to tell a story coming in and really work with our producers to, I think, create something magical. I hope that listeners get to hear it.
Well, I would recommend it. Go online, snapjudgment.org. Find that story and many others, I'm sure, as well. But it's well worth the listen. So give us your story, Glenn. How did you get started with this kind of stuff?
Well, like most people, it was all a big accident, at least in this field. I came to storytelling honestly. You know, I grew up in an apocalyptic, end of days, white supremacist Jesus cult.
Wow. Wow.
Yes. And so, especially as a black person, that it's if you're going to say that Jesus is going to come next week and Jesus doesn't show up. But well, you got some explaining to do, right? And so I in a lot of ways, I studied at the feet of masters. I didn't know that. I didn't appreciate, should I say, how crazy that world was that I was living in. And it wasn't until I left in my late teens and got to have some space, I was like, what was all that about? And realizing, too, that the only thing, like all my education, the only thing I knew how to do was basically start cults. And I didn't want to do that. so I had to figure out something else to do. And it launched me on a different type of journey. And your story was just really important. I saw how important, how it defined the community that I lived in, how these stories would make you move 2,000 miles away, how a story would determine who you married, where you lived, where you sent your school kids to school, or if you pulled them out of school entirely. The story we tell about ourselves, to ourselves, is the most important thing there is often. And I really wanted to investigate the power of what story actually meant. Because this is not, we're not reporters in a classic sense. How someone perceives their world is almost more important than whatever some objective reality might be. And that's what we're trying to get at. What do you, how did you experience this? How do you feel? What did it make you do? What do you see? What do you love? What do you care about? And I know this as well, that, you know, before I started Snap Judgment, I was watching Crossfire, the TV show, and you have, you know, two idiots braying at each other.
Polarized ideologies.
Right. Yeah. Two guys screaming at each other, whatever it may be. And no one in the history of time has ever changed their mind from watching that show, ever. But I found that people's mind changes all the time when they hear someone's own personal story. And it, I think it's like this, when we don't put up our guards, our shields. It's like, look, this is what happened to me. And this is my journey. And it changes people. It, you know, we want this show to be as smart as any show that's ever been produced. And I think that a lot of our producers deliver that. But we also have another target, and that is the heart. No one's ever done anything. No one's ever got up off their couch unless you hit both the heart and the mind. And that's what this show tries to do.
Well, in public radio, we sometimes refer to these moments as driveway moments, where you can't get out of the car. You got to hear the rest of it. But your background is so varied. Your blurb here on the website says you worked as an educator, diplomat, community activist, actor, political strategist, fist shaker, mountain hollerer, and foot stomper. You've been in other countries. You were educated partly in Japan. You have a law degree from the University of Michigan. So a lot of paths led to where you are today. Let's talk about the way the show is actually put together, because you put one of these on every week. How long is this in the process before it's broadcast or streamed?
Wow. Most shows probably take between maybe around 4 months is probably our average, maybe 4 to 6 months to create a story from pitch to broadcast. It's an enormous amount of work goes into each piece. I mentioned that we're not reporters, but we want things to be, we don't want to lie to anyone either. And we want to make sure that what's going on, we've done our due diligence with it. And a huge part of Snap Judgment storytelling is the soundscapes that we want to drop audiences into. There is an original score created for each and every single piece that airs on Snap Judgment. And it's this team of musicians here that are I just can't say enough about them, how there's sort of a dual narration aspect. certainly the storyteller is telling their story, but we also, because this is radio, because this is audio, we want to really drop people into what's happening. And that is done through this very, very lush soundscape that accompanies the storytellers.
Glenn Washington is the creator and host of Snap Judgment. You can hear it Saturdays at 5 Central here on the Prairie Public Network. And Glenn, we are in a period of transition in terms of this technology, and you're talking about the richness of the sound that you can create. Technology makes it now possible for us to stream remarkably good audio. And I say stream because radio is sort of fading into history. I mean, we still broadcast, we still have transmission towers, but we remind people that we're streaming at the same time. You are producing, in a sense, for people who don't own radios, aren't you? A younger audience?
Yeah, that's been so interesting. And it's been so interesting in so many different ways, the evolution of our medium. Now, we say, I take great pride in being a radio broadcaster. And I also thought, you know, when we first started Snap Judgment, I thought that the best place, because we take so much time to make these stuff sound good. We put so much effort into the sound that I thought, you know what? The best place to hear Snap Judgment would be on a sound stage somewhere or an auditorium. That's where you should listen to this show and da 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 with a nice glass of port or something like that. But subsequently, we've just seen the rise of Headphone Nation, where, you know, people go into their own little worlds just by putting their earbuds in. And that really has been an amazing gift for us, because it's all well and good to listen to my show, and I appreciate it. When you're driving down the street, the kids are screaming in the car, you got to get out and get some diapers or whatever it may be. That's an environment. If people listen to my show doing that thing, thank you. Thank you. I'm glad that we're keeping you going during that time period. But if you put your earbuds in and you listen to Snap Judgment, I've got you in a completely different way. Now you're in my world. And we, again, are going to use every single trick of this complete audio toolbox, from sound to Foley to, the volumes, the music. We're going to use every single thing that we can to make sure that you hear the story and experience it from the perspective of the person telling it.
So the difference, radio being occasionally a background sound and this being a more immersive experience. When you go online to snapjudgment.org, and we're talking with Glenn Washington, one of the principals behind this radio show or streaming show, you have some tips for people who want to pitch stories to you. And I found that fascinating, because it was kind of a short course in how to write a short story, or for that matter, as Jacoby Cochran did last week with the Time Traveler piece, something that actually intersected with an essay. You give people writing tips, how to pitch to you.
Yeah, that little chart that you're referring to was created by Stephanie Fu, who was one of our first hires. I want to just do a humble brag here. We hired the best people ever. Stephanie Fu came in as an intern. The very first season, she became one of the most prolific radio producers in probably modern history, and went on to work for This American Life, and is now writing a book. Our second hires was Roman Mars, who went on to create the amazingly popular podcast 99% Invisible. That's where that guide came from. But I just say that to say this: the best way to pitch a story to Snap Judgment is to have a story about someone who wants something. What do you want? And it's going to try, come hell or high water, to get it. Our heroes, are in search of something, and they may get it, they may not, but there's going to be some bobs and weaves along the way. And at the end, they're probably going to be a much different person than they were at the beginning. The best stories, of course, are the stories where I don't see the ending coming. Something's going to happen because it's real life. And real life, you don't see the ending coming. And I love to be surprised with the storyteller as they tell their own story.
I was intrigued by one element of this page of pitch ideas, and that is tropes to avoid. And here are a couple that just jumped out. Something really sad or tragic happened to me, and I got over it by doing something positive. Or, I am an American, and I met a bunch of impoverished foreign people, and they taught me about privilege or appreciating what I have.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we've heard a few variations of that, but the bottom line, the page ends with the truth. The story should be true to the best ability of the person telling it.
Right. And because the truth, we say this casually and flippantly, but the truth is so much stranger than fiction. Two people can experience the same event and come back with different truths. And that's fine for us. I want to hear what happened to you. How did you engage the situation you found yourself in?
Well, what is this week's show? What are we going to hear next?
I have no idea. Let me show. That's a good question. Well, I'll tell you what. I have no idea what this show is dropping. This is the problem right now when you're working
4 months in advance.
4 months in advance. Yeah. What's coming out right now? I've got no clue. But I will say this. During our very first season, we decided to do a Halloween episode that uses our same approach of what is your truth? What happened to you? Tell me your story. To use that with people who have experienced brushes with the supernatural. And we did it for fun. I've certainly had my own share growing up in this kind of crazy condition that I did. And we called it, you know, our very first season, Spooked One. And we put that out and it ended up being really, really, really popular. And we did it every year for Halloween. And the popularity, the calls, the emails, the cards about this show. Finally, 3 years ago, we spun that off as a separate podcast called Spooked. And the response has been off the charts. And so we're going to have two different Spook specials that are coming from that podcast that are going to air around the Halloween time. And I think your audiences are really, really going to dig them. Called Spooked. If you haven't checked it out, Snap Judgment Presents Spooked is a separate podcast now. And it's tons of stories there. And it's a whole lot of fun.
Well, the show is called Snap Judgment. You can hear it Saturdays at 5 Central on Prairie Public, and you might want to go online to snapjudgment.org and binge listen. It's well worth it. Glenn Washington, creator and host of the show, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. What's the difference between the mind and the brain, and why does it matter? If our thoughts are just electrical impulses and chemical reactions, how can we have morality and free will? Join me and my guest, Patricia Churchland, as we address these puzzles and more during How Important is the Brain to the Great Philosophical Questions? On the Next Why Radio, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 7th. French aristocrat Marquis de Mors founded the town of Medora in the spring of 1883 on the east side of the Little Missouri River, across from a small military outpost. His empire is best known for ranching, but the crafty Marquis had other business interests too. He shipped salmon from the Columbia River to the East Coast. He also had ideas for building a pottery works and growing cabbages under glass. One of his projects was a stagecoach line from Medora to Deadwood in the Black Hills, the Medora Stage and Forwarding Company. It was a shorter run than the stage serving Deadwood from Pier. DeMore envisioned the stage carrying mail, passengers, and freight to the bustling gold mining town. The Badlands Cowboy newspaper and the Dickinson Press disagreed over the best route to Deadwood. Dickinson, you see, was also jockeying for a Black Hills route. Each paper cited the other town's proposed road as impassable, but the Marquis had a route surveyed from Sully Creek across the Heart River's headwaters and branches of the Grand and Cannonball Rivers and through hills and valleys south into the Black Hills. But he had problems with the managers of the stage line. He felt cheated by two Medora characters and sought his third manager in A.T. Packard, the editor of the Badlands Cowboy newspaper. When Packard said he knew nothing about stage lines, DeMore said it made no difference. Packard took the job. The Marquis promised to secure a mail contract. Packard waited impatiently for money from DeMore to establish the stage line. Eventually, the money came, but in small sums, delayed over the summer. Packard began buying up horses at bargain prices. The horses were wild and unbroken and thrashed when restrained by harnesses and collars. A series of relay stations were established all along the route. On this date in 1884, Packard was in the midst of a dry run of the stage line returning to Medora from Deadwood. Six horses pulled the 11-seat Concord coach. The trip lasted 35 and a half hours, or 2 days and one night. The stage line was met with enthusiasm, but its demise was soon to come. There was no mail contract. Packard went back to his newspaper and his duties as Medora's chief of police. The Medora Stage and Forwarding Company was discontinued months later, in the spring of 1885. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Jack Dura. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
President Trump is not the only wealthy person to benefit from the tax code.
Our system allows rich people to pay far lower taxes than people that work for a living.
How real estate developers and investors take advantage, and the vice presidential debate on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, so you can listen to us that way as well. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Tomorrow on our show, we'll visit with Mindy Greiling, the author of Fix What You Can, Schizophrenia, and a Lawmaker's Fight for Her Son. Greiling served as a Minnesota state legislator for 20 years, and her book documents her family's struggles and her legislative efforts to help improve the state's mental health system. Tom Eastern will have a Plainsfolk essay for us, and Sue Balcom will drop by for Main Street Eats to talk about pizza. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.